Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Marcia Joyner with Betrayed by Hospice. Thank you, Marty, for having the shows for us. The reason for this show is to warn people that hospice you once heard was compassionate and came in at the end of life to give care and support is no longer the hospice in many cases. Some of you may have had very positive experiences with hospice and received compassionate care for your loved ones. Many of our guests, as well as myself, have not experienced that kind of hospice. We don't say that all hospices are bad, but many are rogue, and they hasten death without the patient's knowledge or consent. Someone pointed out to me today that we keep calling this stealth euthanasia, which what we mean by that is it happens right in front of your eyes. You don't know that it's happening. You trust what the doctors say, and stealth euthanasia it is, but it's murder. Many of our guests have lost people and their loved ones to this, and their death has been hastened with being sedated with opioids, antipsychotic drugs, until they die from the drugs, starvation, and dehydration. The last days of their life are taken from the patient and from their family. They don't get to say goodbye. The reason I do this show is my mom was one of those who was cruelly murdered in June of 2017 in a hospice in Georgia. It took my sister and me 6 months to find out that our case wasn't unique and it had been happening across the country. That's when I met Ron Panzer, who was our guest a couple of weeks ago. Our purpose is to warn you before you allow them to give your loved one any medications or yourself when you're alert and the medical profession wants to give them any medications that you check the medications out first. Google them, ask questions. And if you don't want them to give it to it, you have the right, and you have the right to take your loved one out of that environment. That's why we have these shows. Tonight, we're privileged to have Dr. Paul Byrne with us. He is a neonatalist and a clinical professor of pediatrics. And while he has a background with premature babies, he is no stranger to life being taken before its time, and he advocates for anyone who cannot speak for themselves. He is the producer of a film, Continuum of Life. He's an author of Life Support and Death, Beyond Brain Death, and Brain Death is Not Death. He has presented testimony on life-death issues to 9 state legislatures, and he has openly opposed Dr. Jack Kevorkian. He's authored articles in medical and law journals against euthanasia, abortion, and brain death. He is a steadfast pro-life advocate and a supporter of the American Life League, and he focuses on end-of-life issues. He was also the co-founder of the Life Guardian Foundation, which we'll get into later because they have a lot of important information on that page. A bit about him personally, he was married to Shirley for 48 years until she passed on Christmas Day in 2005, naturally. They are proud parents of 12 children and grandchildren, grandparents of 36 grandchildren, and he has 5 great-grandchildren. Paul, I'd like to give you an opportunity to make some opening statements, if you would like, before we go into some questions. So we are honored to have you with us.
Marcia, thank you very much for inviting me to be on your program. The issues that have to do with life and death are across the board, and they're many in the pro-life movement that focus on the issue of abortion, and abortion is certainly a serious matter, and it's the ending the life of an unborn baby who's defenseless. And in my own situation, so far as my practice of medicine is concerned, I am a pediatrician, and I was one of the founders of the neonatal intensive care unit at Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital in 1963. And what was happening at that time is that essentially every baby that had trouble with breathing that was less than 3 pounds and 4 ounces died. It was 100% mortality, and it seemed to I would say many of us at that time, although it was not a large number, it seemed like we should be able to do something. And so we began. And when we began, we really had no treatments. And we didn't have any ventilators that would be effective on newborn babies. So ventilator for a premature baby had to be invented. And that ventilator that was invented for the 2-pound baby, keep in mind the 2-pound baby, the ventilator has to be very sensitive, it has to be very gentle, it has to be very precise. Well, that ventilator that was invented for that 2-pound baby is the same ventilator that's used for all ages now. And it comes right out of taking that situation that was considered to be hopeless at that time. The only thing when we started, the only thing we did when a baby weighed 2 pounds or 2.5 pounds and had trouble with breathing, we would essentially observe them and come back within 24 hours, at the very most 48, and pronounce them dead. If they believed in baptism, we would see that they got baptized. But we had no treatments, and by taking that situation that there was no treatment, out of that came not only treatment for those little babies. Now most all of them live. It's just the very tiniest and the very immature that don't survive. Such a change. The other thing I'll just mention that is important is that little babies have small amounts of blood, and so micro techniques for analyzing the blood had to be invented. And those micro techniques are used for analyzing the blood of all of us. I mention those two things because by taking those little babies that seem to be hopeless and saying, "Let's see what we can do," not only did treatments get better for those premature babies, but things that came out of that, like the ventilator, like microtechnique, affects all of us. Now, if you go on then to where and you're most very interested in hospice, and for reasons that happened in your life that draw your attention to it, the situation so far as having respect for life, the respect for life must be from true conception until true death. And what happens is if we don't respect the life at any time, whether that be in the very young or the very old or the very sick, those that are unconscious, unable to defend themselves. If we do not respect their life, then if we don't respect the life of anyone, then it's just a matter of time until there's someone else the life we don't respect, until it gets to where the life of every one of us is affected. And the hospice is very important, and it's of some interest that at the same time when I was dealing with the issues that have to do with brain death and related matters, there were other organizations, Euthanasia Society of America, and that kind of thing, and there are a number of common denominators, and the people that were involved with getting euthanasia going in the United States were the same ones that were involved with getting brain death to be accepted. And sometimes people don't see the identification between them, but they are all related, is what I would say. And then the hospice, when it was started, for whatever reason, I'm sure that it seemed to be a good thing to do, but you've had experience that was not positive, and those of us that pay attention to hospice have such experiences, and of course they have put together hospice and palliative care, and they actually have developed a subspecialty or specialty in medicine for palliative care and hospice, and lumping them together, and of course the hospice, for a patient to get into hospice, often it was required to have two doctors to say that the patient would be dead within 6 months. Well, some experiences that I've had in my own life, my own relatives, my cousin who had cancer of the lung and really did everything she could to get treatment for herself, then got put into hospice, and so my wife and I go to see her, she is pretty sleepy, and I asked the nurse if they would just hold off on giving her medication so that we would be able to talk with her, and when we were gone just a few minutes, why medication was given anyway. So that's one of the experiences that I have myself. More recently, a good friend of mine who was 94 years old active, alert, mentally she was fine, she was taken on a picnic with a group and fell backwards, hitting her shoulder, she did have injury to the body of the vertebrae, which doesn't cause any kind of paralysis, some pain and some discomfort from it, but not a great deal of problem. And then what happened was her niece had power of attorney, and her niece put her on hospice. So in a few days when I went back to see her, I asked her, my friend, if she wanted me to pray, and she said yes. And as she started to sit up, the attendant said something, and with that, the hospice nurse arrived to give her an injection. And when I asked what that was, it was morphine and Ativan. And it was about 48 hours until she was no longer on Earth. It was an example of where the power of attorney, if the power of attorney makes a decision, there isn't anything that anybody can do much to stop it. Power of attorney, that is power given to someone to speak for you when you can't speak for yourself. It's important to make sure that someone will be there to protect and preserve your life. And that's all the power of attorney should be able to do, is to protect and preserve your life. In this case, it happened to be a relative who had power of attorney, and really there's nothing anybody can do to, at least there's very little anybody can do to overcome that. The other thing I would mention so far as hospice is concerned is that what I see happening, and I had this situation with my own wife, that if I would have agreed to hospice, then some of her home health needs would have been paid for, but in order to do that, I would have had to give up her own doctors and turn her treatment and care over to hospice doctors, and I was not about to do that. But on the other hand, I was able to do other things to help my wife, but it takes money to do that, and our system is such, and I've learned many things about the system from my wife being ill, and then my sister, who is 97, and things that we've gone through with her. And what happens is that Medicare will pay for something according to the illness for a certain number of days, and then there'll be a certain number of days that will be paid for in what they call rehab, but of course those are nursing homes. And some are better than others, I can tell you that much, and some are not as good as others, which is another way to say the same thing. But what happens, though, is that the financial support runs out. And then what will happen is, under the current Medicare situations, if they get put in hospice, they will get their care paid for, and so it becomes a financial incentive for people to go into hospice, and the people are not equipped to deal with it so far as taking care of their mother or father or their loved one. So all of these things are going on, and everybody learns it when they get in the system. They think everything is okay and everything is there to take care of them, and then they find out from their own experience that things aren't always there to protect and preserve their life, put in another thing that I deal with, and I began to deal with this part of it in 1975. Remember, I started the special care nursery in 1963, and by that time we were progressing to where we were able to help babies more by the time we get to 1975. And Joseph was born very prematurely and was on the ventilator for several weeks, and he would not move or not respond, and a brainwave test was done on him, and the brainwaves were flat, and it was interpreted as consistent with cerebral death. And this was repeated in about 2 days and was unchanged, and it was suggested to stop treating him. But we continued to treat him, and eventually Joseph got off the ventilator. Joseph got out of the hospital, went home, went to school, got excellent grades in school, ran track, played baseball. He's married, has three children. So that began my study of brain death, and I was in academic environment at that time, a professor of pediatrics, and we tried to do things, make advances in accord with scientific principles or principle of scientific studies, that kind of thing. And so 1975, when Joseph had consistent with cerebral death written on his chart, and it did not fit the clinical situation of Joseph, I did begin my study immediately. But by the time about 6 months went on and Joseph was continuing to live, I began investigating what this thing called brain death was all about. And at that time, it did not apply to infants. In fact, it didn't apply to anybody under the age of five. And that didn't make any sense to me. How could there be something happening to the brain in somebody who is six but it wouldn't be happening to a brain in somebody who's four. That didn't make any sense, just that part of it. So investigating it, it became clear that brain death was invented in 1968, and I really mean it was invented. It was not based on any kind of scientific studies that would be acceptable for anything else in medicine. And basically what they did in 1968, because they wanted to do a heart transplant, and the fact of the matter is they had done at least two heart transplants, maybe three that I know of, before that, and they cut the beating heart out of a person in South Africa, and then they cut the beating heart out of a baby in Brooklyn, New York, and it was illegal in Brooklyn. It was immoral. And so what they did is set up a committee at Harvard known as the Harvard Committee. And the Harvard Committee published an article called A Definition of Irreversible Coma. And out of that article grew brain death. And basically what it says is that when somebody is unconscious on a ventilator, even while their heart was beating and had circulation and respiration, they could be called dead. And they did it without any studies on animals, dogs, cats, rats. They didn't do any studies on human beings. They just invented it. And remember, that happened in 1968. Joseph didn't come into my life until 1975. So from 68 to 75 or thereabouts, I was like all the other doctors. I thought that whatever was happening with these issues of brain death, that it was in accord with good medicine. 1975, 76, it became clear to me that it was not in accord with good medicine, and I published the first article in 1977 and published an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1975 taking a stand against these against brain death, and I've been taking the stand ever since. Now, why is it so important to what you're interested in, Marcia? It's because what they did in 1968, when they could call somebody dead while the heart was beating in circulation, then why can't they take somebody who has a serious illness and do things like give them less treatment, like give them medications, like morphine, like Ativan? Why not be able to do that to them if at the same time you can call somebody else with a beating heart circulation? If you can call them dead and cut their organs out, that is, cannibalize them while they're still alive, then why isn't it's much less to just give them morphine and Ativan until they're dead? And these issues, I think, are related. Every now and then I run into somebody and said, well, where are the scientific articles that tie these two things together? And the only thing I can tell you is that the people that were involved with starting brain death, many of the same ones are the same ones that are involved with propagating hospice and palliative care. So with that, I'll stop and see what you and I can talk about, Marcia.
Okay. So since we've already started with the brain death, let me kind of go over that since we're there. So the fact that somebody is declared brain dead because they haven't done any research and they don't know what you feel, even if they say you don't have brain waves, is it actually known that when you go to cut somebody's heart out, that they are not alive, that they don't feel anything?
Well, first of all, they are alive.
Every
time every time an organ is taken, it's a healthy organ. Who would want to get an organ that wasn't healthy? Well, where do you get healthy organs? You get them from living persons.
You can't get that from a cadaver.
Can't get it from a cadaver. And so far as brain data is concerned, what that means is it's really brainwashing is what it is, because you hear brain dead, and part of how brainwashing is done is just give people two words, and they will hear the most prominent word. So you give them brain death, and they hear death. And it's in some ways it's similar to life insurance. You hear life insurance. Excuse me. You think life, but in fact it's death. But who would buy death insurance? And yet life insurance has nothing to do with life. It only has to do with death. But they couldn't sell it if they called it death insurance, so they call it life insurance. Brain death only gets into your head that somebody is dead. If you take the ordinary person, then ordinary folks know things about creatures. They know things about their dog, their cat. They know things about earthworms. They know things about birds, and they know that they have life, and of course the study of that life is biology, and they also know that there is something that's death, and death is without life. Well, so if they were to think about the bird that they find, if the bird has evidence of life, you don't call it dead. If your pet dog or cat, if the heart is beating, and you know that, you wouldn't call your pet dog dead. The dog can have a serious problem. The cat can't, but not dead. Well, what brain death is calling somebody dead when they have a beating heart in circulation, and they're not truly dead. They are all alive. Everybody who's called brain deaf is alive. Everybody. There's no exception. And every one of them has a beating heart and circulation. Well, what happens? You go to the license bureau to get your driver's license for the first time, or to get it removed, or to get it renewed, and they ask you, do you wish to be an organ donor? They don't tell you that to be an organ donor, you have to have a beating heart circulation. They don't tell you that. They don't tell you that the way they take the organs under those circumstances is they make an incision from the neck to the pelvis. It's literally called a 2-foot incision. And when they open up the chest, they see the beating heart. Everybody in the operating room sees the beating heart. They all know that they're alive. But what it is they want to get those organs because there are people out there that are claiming a need for those organs. They have a desire to get an organ for themselves, and they have a lobby to get organs. There are people out there campaigning to get organs. We're exposed to much advertisement. Give the gift of life, you know. Be an organ donor, and there's nobody that's campaigning out there. At least not very few. There's some of us that are out there trying to help people to know that you must be alive to be an organ donor. So out of this, the people must learn to say no to being an organ donor. There's no way to get an organ from a cadaver, so they have to know that. The other thing that happens in this declaration of brain death, and incidentally, 1968 was the Harvard criteria was published, and between 68 and 78, there were 30 different sets of criteria published, of which you could be dead by one but be alive by the others. But all of the sets of the criteria all have a common test that's done with all of them, and it's called an apnea test. It isn't simply a test where you do a test on blood or you take an x-ray or something like that. It's a procedure, and the procedure is to take away the life-supporting ventilator and to take away the life-supporting ventilator for 10 minutes. They suffocate the patient for 10 minutes. It makes the carbon dioxide in the blood go up. And when the carbon dioxide in the blood goes up, that increases the swelling in the brain. It makes them get worse. They do this every time. So the audience must learn no to organ donation, and they must learn no to the apnea test. If they have a relative that's in the hospital, unconscious and on a ventilator, they will want to do an apnea test. They won't ask for permission. They go ahead and do it. They do this to them, so you have to be alert to it, and you have to tell them up front you don't want the apnea test done. And these two notes are absolutely essential. Go ahead.
Okay, just let me say that is not to be confused with a sleep apnea test that would be run. I just want to make
correct.
That clarification.
It's a good clarification.
Right.
Right. Good important clarification, because the sleep apnea test is a test that's done when people have irregular breathing, and the sleep apnea test is sometimes done in a sleep apnea center. Sometimes they're done at home, but that's altogether different from the apnea test, which is better called a procedure of an apnea test. It's something that's done, and so the audience has to learn no to the procedure of the apnea test and no to organ donation. And
so
sleep
with
apnea
this test,
that's a different thing. Good point.
Right, and you said that they won't tell you they're going to do it. They just go ahead and do it. So say, for instance, that somebody comes in and they're in a car wreck and they have a head injury and they're unconscious at the time. So that would be kind of like a situation where they would pull the plug on them for 10 minutes, which would cause the brain to swell more and would cause the patient to possibly then die, so they could say their brain dead, and then they can harvest your organs, right?
Right.
So a severe head injury, I think you had said there is a way to treat a severe head injury, right?
Sure. Give
them a good prognosis, Go ahead.
There are treatments that are very helpful, like some of them that you might hear about, is like hypothermia. They reduce the body temperature, and then one of the things that happens when the brain swells, the hypothalamus, which is part of the brain, stops making the thyroid stimulating hormone, and the thyroid stimulating hormone in just a few hours, it isn't there, so they get hypothyroid, and the hypothyroidism causes the brain to swell, causes the heart not to function, and you can do these things, and it helps the patient who's unconscious and on a ventilator. But you see, what happens is much of this is controlled by the doctors, by the hospital, by the system, and the system is all set up to get organs. You have to have organs in order to have an organ transplant industry, which is what it is. It's an organ transplantation industry. It's coordinated by the federal government, and it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. $34 billion was billed in 2017 for organ transplants. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. It's larger than the abortion industry. And And all of it depends on getting healthy organs from living persons. And so essentially all of the hospitals are involved. The transplant doctors are involved. The intensive care doctors are involved. And while many of them are doing everything they can to help the patient, they also are involved with getting the organs. And so the system is there to get organs, and then what happens is that they don't want to waste money on somebody who's not going to get well. And so all of these things are there, and then people contact me because they have a son or a daughter that's injured in an automobile accident. They are off in another state because they've been away at school or whatever it is, and that kind of thing. And only to find out that trying to do something to help them is very difficult because the system is all set up to get their organs. And the ones that are most vulnerable are the ones who are 30 and under, but it expands out from that. And not too long ago, there was a lady who was 40, and I was in touch with her attorney, and he couldn't get the hospital records. I couldn't believe that he couldn't get the hospital records, but they won't give the records, so it's very difficult to help them. And so I couldn't believe, so I got on the plane. I was at the bedside with the attorney, with her husband, and the nurse would not even tell me her temperature, and they would not give us any records. We had to go to court to get a judge to rule to give us records just so we could see anything about it. But it's when you get involved with trying to help them, it's a very closed thing because they don't want to give you the records, because if they give the records, then you have a chance to help them. But they won't give the records. They have all kinds of reasons why they won't give them, can't give them. I mean, I go through these things even where the father will go to the record room. They won't give the records. Repeatedly go back. They won't give the records. And if the records are such that once they're given out, then more people know about them and other things can happen to help the patient. So these are just the things that go on. Many people get in touch with me not only because of the issue of brain death, but because of their loved ones in terms of ventilators, feeding tubes, and those kind of things. And many times they give up, the system gives up because they are somebody who is older. Not too long ago, a man got in touch with me about his mother, and the situation was that because of circulation, had problem with circulation to her leg, and so we figured out how if she got a feeding tube and got nutrition and got the leg taken care of, she could possibly live. Well, it's several years now, and she lives very well without that leg, and the feeding tube was necessary only for maybe 6 weeks until her nutrition got better and she was able to eat again. And so things that you can do to help people, even when they're very sick, and staying focused on protect and preserve life. And those are the key words that I help people to know. They're not new words. It's just that the life is there, and then what do we do with our own life? Is we should be protecting and preserving our own life and the life of our loved ones. And the only thing that doctors and nurses ought to do is protect and preserve life. And I teach people that if they're asked, if the nurse is asked to do something, if it will not protect and preserve life, then the nurse should just get away from it. It's not medicine. Medicine only protects and preserves life. Go ahead, Marcia.
Well, you're absolutely right. That is exactly what it should be. I wanted to ask you, go back on something you said earlier. When you were trying to get the records, and we talked about if you have the power of attorney, if the POA was there and asked for the medical records, could they demand that they're giving them to them?
You can demand, but it isn't going to. It doesn't happen. My experience is it doesn't happen. And I go through this where you have a POA or a guardian, and to get the records, they are so protective of the records. They have learned that if they keep control of the records, they have more control of the patient. Incidentally, some of these things grow out of how the HIPAA law is interpreted, and the HIPAA law is part of the system of death, and we're all exposed to the HIPAA law when we enter the hospital. And we have to sign a document that says that records can be released, but will only be released under certain circumstances. And yet the HIPAA law. When I read the HIPAA law, I found 14 ways that the government can get your information without your permission and use it without your permission. And one of them is to get your organs for transplantation. And it's actually the system is set up so that if somebody is unconscious and on a ventilator and it looks like they might die before too long, it's obligatory that the organ procurement organization be notified. And that's part of the HIPAA law, and your records can all be transferred and be made available to the organ procurement organization so they can determine if your organs are going to be good for someone else. And all of that is built in. There's 14 ways that they can use your information without your permission, and we're all being exposed to the concept that the HIPAA law is necessary to protect your records, when in fact I can absolutely assure you that when I went to medical school, just like everybody else went to medical school, about the first day of school, we are told about hospital records and matters with patients are private, and not to talk about them in the cafeteria, not to talk about them in the elevator, and we had it crammed into our heads to keep records private. The nursing schools all did the same thing, and so then the HIPAA law was propagated on the basis that there was some need to keep records private, when in fact the records were always kept private. But what granted that there can be somebody's going to leak things out, but for the most part the doctors and nurses protected the records and did not divulge what was in them. But the reason you had to have the HIPAA law was so you could get organs for transplantation. That's part of why the HIPAA law had to get passed, and there are 13 other ways the government can get your information without your permission, and most people don't pay attention to these laws. It takes a long time to read them and search them out and the like. And when I talk to attorneys who tell doctors what's in the HIPAA law, they don't tell these things about how the HIPAA law is used to for the government to get information without your permission.
Well,
these things, Marcia, they're all interrelated. They're all interrelated to where the specialness of the person is not adhered to. See, persons are living creatures, and but they aren't just living creatures, but they're special. Each person is special, and those of us that believe in the soul, the living person is a unity of the body and the soul. But there's a metaphysical aspect, something beyond the physical, for each and every person, no matter what their beliefs are. Most everybody has some thoughts or ideas about something that's more than just physical for the person. And so the person is special. And as a doctor, I have the a privilege to protect and preserve the life of these special persons, and then when we're little babies, our mothers and fathers love us and protect and preserve us. When we get older, our children protect and preserve us. They love us, but we don't do anything to harm the baby. The children don't do anything to harm the parents. Granted, there are exceptions to these things, but my experience in life is that most people are good and they want to do the right thing, and much of what gets done is in accord with the laws. But the laws in the United States are set up to be able to call you dead when you're still alive. That's called the Determination of Death Act. The Anatomical Gift Act is the law that's set up that they get permission to get the organs. It's set up so that it presumes that everybody intends to be an organ donor. Granted, you have to get permission from somebody, but they intend to do it. So if they intend to do it, you can do every test on the unconscious person to determine if their organs are good. So you have the Anatomical Gift Act, the Determination of Death Act, and you have the HIPAA law, and then you get into things that have to do with Medicare and the hospice and the palliative care, and there's a bill introduced, it's abbreviated POCHETA, POCHETA, and you can look up what those letters are for. But it's to educate more people about palliative care. It's a terrible law. Your listeners need to check into it and get in touch with your congressman to try to keep that law from being passed. It will just propagate more and more the palliative care and the hospice. And palliative care, people don't realize that it's palliative care. The word palliative, P-A-L-L-I-A-T-I-V-E, Paul, the word Paul means to cover up. You might be familiar with that word with pallbearer. That's somebody at a funeral,
right.
Helps to carry the coffin. In the Catholic Church, when the coffin arrives at the door of the church, then a cloth cover is put over the coffin, and that's called a pall. Pall means to cover up. Palliative, what is it that they are covering up? And palliative care means little or no treatment and less care. While hospice can say have two doctors who say you're going to be dead within 6 months, the indications to put you into palliative care, if you're being screened for this, everybody who's a little bit older goes to the doctor, and most people that are a little bit older will identify with this, because when they go in to see the doctor for anything, they are asked questions like, do you live by yourself? Do you need help in dressing? And what this is being screened for is to determine if you can take care of yourself and screened for whether you have depression. You're being screened for anxiety. These things, the Medicare, the doctors get paid a fee for the visit. So everybody who is in Medicare is encouraged to come in to see the doctor when you're well. Theoretically, it's to keep you well, but the system is to pay the doctor when you're well, and then when you're sick, it's to pay the doctor to get you into palliative care, which is less treatment. And the system is like this. And I'm a doctor. I'm part of the system. I just get amazed at how I go to the doctor, and the doctor spends almost all the time putting check marks on the computer screen and hardly knows if I'm there or not. But I have to go in because I haven't been in for 6 months. I don't have to go in because I'm sick. I have to go in because it's 6 months. Why? They can get a fee for 6 months. And then because I stay alert, I find on the chart screen for depression. Well, I had a bellyache from kidney stones, but I wasn't depressed. I was sick. Screen for
right.
anxiety. I might have been anxious, but I didn't have anxiety. But I
right,
look on the chart and I find these things. And these things are going on and they're affecting everybody. And it has to do with the system. And we hear things how Obamacare needs to be changed or whatever it is, and we have to have health care for everybody. What we do need changes in the health care, but the people have to speak up, and the people want to be able to go to the doctor when they're sick. But I don't know that anybody's too excited about going to the doctor when they're well.
The medication, we have put people
right.
on so much medication that, you
yes.
know, medication for antibiotics and, you know, for heart, you know, if your blood pressure is too high or if it's too low or you're a little bit anxious
right.
that's why you have to go back to the doctor, because they will not give you the prescription. So they've kind of got you, pull you back in because you can't get your prescription refilled. But we are taught to trust the doctors and the medical profession because they are there to help us. And
yes.
that is the sad thing now, is that is not necessarily true. And I'd like to, at this point, applaud you for your position on all of this and taking care of people. You are certainly a doctor that I think there should be more like you out there, because you care about life in general. And I think that's marvelous. So I do applaud you for that. Thank you for being one of the good guys.
Well, thank you. I think that most doctors are good and they're trying to do good. I think that many times the doctors find themselves in a system that they don't really care for either, but as you know, they have to make a living and they go along with it. But I think that the system as it now exists will change. I just hope it changes for the better. But your listeners need to get involved. You need to learn about hospice. You need to learn about palliative care. You need to learn about brain death. You need to learn about organ transplantation. It is possible, and this kind of program is is one of the ways to educate about it. We have an organization, Life Guardian Foundation, and they can look it up. It's www.lifeguardianfoundation.org. It's the three words together, lifeguardianfoundation.org. And there you will see many of my presentations, and you'll see many things that have to do with brain death and organ transplants. But we also deal with the other things. Like, we give out a card. It's a medical card, and it's designed to protect and preserve your life. And it says you want to be treated, and you don't want to be an organ donor, and you don't want an apnea test. And so all those things are on that card. We encourage people to get the cards from us and sign them, witness them. And on the cards, you can designate someone to speak for you if you can't speak for yourself. And so you can do that on the card. And I think it's important that that everyone have someone to speak for them when they can't speak for themselves. And one of the groups of people that it's absolutely essential that they have a power of attorney, and that is the youngster who reaches the age of majority, which is 18 in many of the states. What happens is the 18-year-old goes off to college, and then they get involved in a serious situation, and no longer do the parents have anything to say about what happens to their child, because the system is such that once you reach the age of majority, the hospital then will go to the court, and the court will appoint a guardian, and that guardian very likely will not be the mother or the father, because they want to make it that it can be controlled, that the system can have control over it. And these situations, I get involved with the cases where they have already gone to court and got the guardian and that kind of thing, and then the father can't do anything about it. One of the saddest ones that I had to deal with was a little girl in Virginia who choked on popcorn, and in the courtroom, the court appointed another attorney to be the guardian. The father was in the courtroom, the mother was at the hospital with the little girl, there were six other children. Two of them had already reached the age of majority. Either of them could have been the guardian, but the court appointed another attorney to be the guardian. It was so awful for me to listen to the judge to ask the other attorney, not the father who was right there, not the attorney representing the father and the mother, but another attorney to represent the 2-year-old girl who was in the hospital. It was so sad that to have that happen. And so when you get into the guardians, especially when you have the mother, father, and their little girl choked on popcorn, that's no reason to have another guardian appointed. But so when somebody gets to the age of 18, you must have a power of attorney. It's absolutely essential that the power of attorney, and of course, I would expect that 18-year-old to appoint their mother or their father. And incidentally, also you have to have a power of attorney when your children go off and stay with grandmother and grandpa for a week or something like that. And if the parents are out of the country or something like that, you have to have a power of attorney. We help people. We are not a legal firm, but we help people with getting their documents in order, and they can go to their attorney and get it taken care of. But we help people with these things. And yes, what you're doing with the hospice and educating the people, it's absolutely essential. It's only one part of the system of death. You see, the way that I grew up and the way that I learned medicine was from if you want to call it a culture of life, it's really a gift of life, but it revolved around life. Everything revolved around life. It changed in 1960s, especially it changed in 1968 when they published the article about brain death. That changed, so then doctors were able to call their patients dead when they were clearly alive, and it's still that. And that made a major change in the practice of medicine, and so we're seeing the effect of it in the presidential campaign a couple of campaigns ago. when they asked the President Obama about an older person and that kind of thing, unconscious, and he said, "Well, she might have to take her medicine." And it was right out there in the campaign for everybody to hear, and everybody should have been very upset with that, because that medicine is to make them get dead, and so it's a system. It's the medicine that is involved, the laws are involved, and I've learned not to expect help from the clergy. I'm not against clergy. I'm not against doctors. I'm not against lawyers. But in these matters of life and death, it's a system of death. It does not revolve around a culture of life anymore. It's a system of death, and it's important for everybody to learn about it. And we need to have a change. The law ought to be such that no one should be declared dead unless there is evidence of death, you know, unless there is destruction of the circulatory and respiratory system. Shouldn't be calling somebody dead when they have circulation and respiration. Now, if they have any response, I can show you recordings of patients that are moving, their whole body is moving, and they're said to be dead. I mean, it's so ridiculous. It's so ridiculous to see the chest open up and see the heart beating. It's so ridiculous to call them dead. They're not dead. They're alive. And yet, legally, they're dead. And with the way the Determination of Death Act is set up.
And at that point, they're considered to have no value other than perhaps having an organ that somebody can harvest. Right.
Yes.
Let me go back to a couple of things that you said, because I want to make this really clear. The Uniform Anatomical Gift Act overrides, if you've gone out there and you've told somebody on your driver's license you do not want to be an organ donor, this act overrides that. And what Dr. Byrne was talking about, on their website, they have a medical card to protect and preserve life that you want to get, and fill it out and keep it in your wallet or your billfold, because it says that I do not want to be an organ donor. And that's a sad thing to say now, because you always felt like you were doing something good. If I'm gone and somebody can use my eyesight or my heart or, you know, a lung or a kidney, liver, we've wanted to be compassionate and give that. But as has been pointed out, you put yourself in a really bad position, because they're not going to fight hard to save you, because your organ's going to be worth more money to them to give to somebody else. So this card is to protect and preserve your life. It's very important that you go fill this out, get it notarized, signed, and on the power of attorney for health care. I went to your site, and for $2, you can get this. It's a digital file. You can bring it down and you fill it out. There are three different files there. One of them is the Power of Attorney for Health Care, the Directions to Protect and Preserve Life for Power by Power of Attorney for Health Care, and the one that you talked about for minors. And for $2 nominal fee, you can get these documents, get them signed, keep them with you. Have somebody that you say is going to take care of you, that will value your life. And sadly, we see cases where the individual, whether it's the spouse or the child, they don't want to deal with the elderly person anymore, and they are actually involved in their murder with hospice. So if there's any chance that that's happening in your family situation, you don't want to put that person to have power of attorney over you. So you need to be really sure that the person wants to keep you alive more than to let you go because you're a burden or because you have money that they want. So
yes.
I just wanted
and
to
the,
make sure
the
that those,
that,
those
Marcia,
documents are out there.
The way I say
so
that, Marcia,
you want to give,
make sure that you designate someone to speak for you. That's make sure that someone loves you and
right.
not that someone would love to get rid of you.
Exactly, Exactly. And the website, again, is www.lifeguardianfoundation.org. And that's all together. And there is a ton of information out there. So I'm sorry, I just wanted to make sure that everybody knew about that. So
yes.
You mentioned the feeding tube. One of the things that we've talked about in the past is if someone is given a feeding tube, that sometimes hospice says, you know, we don't want to do that. But because you put somebody on a feeding tube, does that necessarily mean that they're never going to come off of the feeding tube and they'll never be able to eat again? I mean, isn't it just to give them sustenance for that period of time?
Yes, it is. And you know, there are advantages to being a doctor for a long time. But when I was a much younger doctor, the only kind of tubes we had were rubber tubes. In fact, of the matter is, when I got into medicine, the IV tubing was rubber tubing, is what it was, and it would have to be washed out and used again for another patient, is the way it was. It was before plastics, and then so far as getting back to the feeding tubes, they were just rubber, and then plastic was invented, and then the first plastics were not like the plastics are now. The plastics now that we use for feeding tubes that are just like cooked spaghetti. They're soft, so pliable, and they stay that way. And then so far as a feeding tube is concerned, with taking care of premature babies, feeding tubes are, we do that all the time. We feed the little babies with feeding tubes. And for 50 years, we put the feeding tube through the belly wall of the baby when at the time of operation, because it made it so much easier to take care of them with the feedings that we gave them and that kind of thing. And so we had lots of experience. Then where we get up to modern times now, the feeding tube that is commonly used is called a PEG tube. It's the PEG, all capital letters, and it means per esophageal gastrostomy. The per means, as a Latin word, means through, and then the esophagus is the swallowing tube between the mouth and the stomach, and then the gastrostomy, gastro means stomach and opening to the stomach. So that feeding tube, I have patients that I've gotten them to go into the hospital to as an outpatient and get that feeding tube put in. They use local anesthetic. They can, with a scope, look down the esophagus, and then with a light on the end, show where the incision needs to be made. And with local anesthetic, it can be put in sometimes as quick as 10 minutes. It's common 20 minutes. The feeding tube can be put in, and then it makes it easier to take care of the patient and easier to feed them. And if they get nutrition for a period of time, then they get well again, and then they get back to where they can eat in the regular way. That happens often enough that I can assure you that it does happen. Just because you give them a feeding tube doesn't mean they'll be on the feeding tube the rest of their life. On the other hand, you see what happens to live on Earth, Martha. You have to have water. If you don't have water, in 1 to 2 weeks, everybody is dead. And you have to have food. If you don't have food, in 1 to 2 months, everybody is dead. You have to have oxygen. In a matter of minutes, without oxygen, you will be dead. And so to live on Earth, you have to have oxygen, you have to have water, you have to have nutrition, and there has to be a way for urine to get out and for bowel movements to get out. Those things are absolutely essential to live on Earth. And without them, death occurs quickly. And in modern times, and remember, it's in within my lifetime when we've gone from the feeding tube that was rubber and not easy for the patient and lots of disadvantages to to where we have modern plastics that, that can be done very easily. And so it's the kind of thing, and every patient is different, but most of the time, water helps to keep them alive, and water helps to keep them comfortable. I say water, we don't use just plain water when we put it in the vein. It'll be sugar, glucose water we talk about, or glucose with some lactated bringer, a little bit of salt in it because it's not irritating, that kind of thing. We learned a long time ago, if you just give somebody glucose, then they don't lose salt. They don't make ketones and acetone, and you can smell it in their breath sometimes. And that makes them uncomfortable. And if you just give them some sugar and some water, they're so much more comfortable. And these kinds of things that can be done to help patients, and when patients aren't able to help themselves, then we do things to help them because they're special. Each person is special and unique. And so there are different ways that we can help patients to live. Now, the other thing, Marsha, I'll bring up that you and I have talked about briefly, and that's a do not resuscitate order. I am very concerned about a do not resuscitate order. It's a very broad order, is what it is. And if you ask somebody what do they mean by do not resuscitate, they may or may not give you some kind of answer that if they stop breathing, they don't want to have anybody help them to breathe or whatever it is. But it's a very broad order, and I'll use an example if I, as a doctor, expected to write an order that's very specific. For instance, and if I would write an order or tell a nurse an order, a very broad order, like if I said to the nurse, give antibiotics. The nurse would say, well, doctor, what kind of antibiotics? And I said, well, make it ampicillin. And then what would she say? She would say, well, how much? And so then I'd have to tell her how much. And then she would say, by what route? Do you mean by mouth or in the vein, or how do you mean it? And then she would say, how often? So you see, doctors are used to writing specific orders. What the medication is, how often to give it, what route to give it, but we don't write broad orders. So if it gets into matters of life and death and not resuscitating, how can we write a broad order of do not resuscitate, which can mean no help with breathing, no tube down the throat to help with breathing. It can mean no electric shock to shock the heart back. It can mean not answering the alarm when it goes off quite so soon. I have seen it once somebody got into this do not resuscitate kind of situation, then maybe pastoral care doesn't get called quite so soon. Maybe they get called sooner, but there's an effect of do not resuscitate. So I don't think that they should ever use a do not resuscitate order. If there is a situation, and there's really only three situations that you have to do something about, or the patient will die, and that quickly. And that is if a patient stops breathing, you have to do something, or they're going to die quickly. If their heart stops, you have to do something, or they're going to die quickly. If their blood pressure goes down, you're going to have to do something, or they're going to die quickly. And those are the only three situations that that you have to, if you don't want them done, then and there could be a reason why not to do some of those, whatever they are. I would accept that, but it would have to be a specific order for that particular situation at that time, and it needs to get reevaluated again tomorrow. It would be something to get you through the night or to get you through this current situation, but it certainly ought to be reevaluated at least every day. So that if you're going to decide that somebody's not going to get something, it ought to be a specific, not getting a specific something. I remember a little boy who was declared brain dead, and the nurse called and said his blood pressure was going down. So I went over to the hospital and talked to his mother, and I said, your son's blood pressure is going down. Do you want me to do anything to help the blood pressure? She said, well, what can you do? I said, well, we can give medication, and sometimes the medication helps. And she looked up at me and said, well, get on with it. So I gave the little boy medicine for his blood pressure, and he lived 20 years. And never got anything for his blood pressure again. And if he had had a do not resuscitate order, he never would have gotten the blood pressure. And he also, very likely, the nurse would not have called me to see him. So I see a do not resuscitate as as not a good medical order. We do have a booklet that people can get from American Life League. It's called Life Support and Death. And so I would encourage people to get that. And in that booklet, we do address these issues about what do you do. And the basic principle is protect and preserve life. If you get into a particular situation of deciding that something is not going to be done, well, then at least make it a specific thing for a specific amount of time and not for a very long time until you reevaluate.
Well, to me personally, I will not ever sign a DNR. And my dad lives with me. He's 91, and we've torn his up. So DNRs are not something. I didn't know about the organ donor. But, you know, that I'm going to also take care of since I read on your site about it. So I just personally, I say do not sign a DNR, my personal opinion. Let me just kind of throw this out there. If anybody's listening and you have a question or a comment, if you select one on your telephone, it will put you in a queue with Marty, and then you can ask a question. But I wanted to go back to your co-founding of Life Guardian Foundation. So can you tell us, I know that you've got a lot of forms out there, but what is the mission of that site and what can it do to help some of our listeners besides the documentation that we've talked about?
Well, basically our goal and objective is to protect and preserve life from conception until true death. And we don't have any exceptions to that. And actually, we use the term true conception and true death. And the conception and death, these are words that have meaning, but they get distorted. And, you know, like with conception, they try to make conception be implantation. Well, that's just foolish. Implantation occurs about a week after conception. And so to say, well, we're not going to call it conception until implantation, well, that's just foolish. And yet there are people out there that advocate such things. So I say, well, it has to be true conception. And then so far as death is concerned, you have these issues about brain death, cardiac death, and whatever other kind, but the word death means the absence of life. It's the demarcation point where life ends and death is there, and then what you have is at that point the remains of someone. It's a cadaver, it's a dead body, and what do you do with cadavers? embalm them, bury them, cremate them, that kind of thing. With brain death, you embalm them, you would kill them. And obviously you can't cremate them. So what is this thing called brain death? It means that you're alive, not dead.
You're alive.
And why do we have the organization? Well, we have the organization because we are a pretty simple organization. We protect and preserve life, and we don't have any exceptions. And, you know, I've been at this for a long time, and there are not a lot of people that will publicly take a stand against brain death and organ transplants. I think inside their hearts they know that somebody is not dead when their heart is beating and there's circulation. And that there's not a lot of organizations that will take a stand. American Life League does, and Judy Brown in American Life League takes a stand, protects and preserves life across the board. I don't speak for any of the other organizations. I've worked closely with Judy Brown all these years, she is, and American Life League are supportive, and actually they have printed that book, Life Support and Death, which is co-authored with 8 other doctors and a priest and an attorney, and that's a very good book for everybody to get. It's called Life Support and Death, and you can it used to be that you had to purchase it for $3 from American Life League, but I've heard that it's on their website now that you can download it. But in any event, that's where you can get it, and it's where you get the best direction. Please pardon my bias, but I had a lot to do with writing it. But it's the best, the booklet that has the most information to protect your life, and I encourage everybody to get that book. It's important. So why do we have a Life Guardian Foundation? Because that's what we do: protect and preserve life. And people find us, and we're able to help a lot of people, and not only with the brain death issue, but issues now at this time. You know, I have a man in New York that I'm helping because of his daughter. I have a lady in California that helping her mother, that kind of thing. And they get into situations and they want their relative to live, but they don't have many places to turn. The Terry Schiavo Foundation. They take a stand to protect and preserve life also. So each person has to do this, and they need to get busy and do it now. Learn about these issues from those three organizations, and then whatever you do, Marcia, to educate the people. But they must learn about it. They must learn about it as much as they can before their relative gets into the situation, because then it's much more difficult to deal with it. I encourage everybody to they need to know to say no at the License Bureau, no to the procedure of the apnea test. They need to get a power of attorney. Especially when you get to be 18, you need to have a power of attorney, the only thing the power of attorney should be able to do is protect and preserve your life. The power of attorney shouldn't be there to end your life. It should be to protect and preserve your life. The laws are all set up to make you get less treatment, when in fact all you have to do is don't be concerned about getting too much treatment. The odds are you're not going to get too much treatment. There's too many things involved to make treatment get stopped. So you have to have something to protect and preserve your life. So far as you'll never live 1 second longer than what God says anyway. The ventilator, by the way, only works when somebody is alive. The ventilator doesn't keep them alive. It can only be effective when they are alive. And granted, if you can't take a breath, you're going to die. But the ventilator doesn't make you stay alive. The ventilator just helps you to have respiration and is all that it does. And it only works when you are alive. When people get on ventilators, they die on the ventilator. When you're dead, the ventilator won't do anything. The ventilator, by the way, is a machine that pushes the air in. It doesn't push it out. It's only the living person that pushes it out. It only pushes it in. Our body is such the way that we breathe. We take a breath in, and then our lungs and our chest wall are somewhat analogous to the rubber band, in the sense that it can store energy to get out. The rubber band, when we pick it up, it's as limp as can be, and we stretch it, and it can store energy, so when we let it go, then it bounces back. That's the way we breathe, and it happens the way you and I are breathing, that our muscles of the chest wall, our diaphragm, contract, and that makes the air spaces get bigger, and the air goes in, and when that stops, then the recoil, the elastic properties of the chest wall and the diaphragm is what pushes the air out. It's the same way on the ventilator. The ventilator only pushes the air in. It only works when you're alive. When you're dead, the ventilator won't do anything. Don't worry. You won't get the ventilator for too long. And just know that it's a very good treatment. It helps a lot of people. And really, when we put somebody on a ventilator these days, our goal and objective is to get them off the ventilator as quickly as possible, because it's something to help them tie them over. Same way with the feeding tube, something to tie them over. And so these kinds of treatments are good to do, and people have to learn, protect, and preserve life, and don't do anything to hasten death or shorten life, and be very careful about these medications. Incidentally, morphine, you should know that the first effect of morphine is to decrease the cough. That's the first thing. And when cough gets decreased, then what you get is pneumonia and heart failure. And of course, if morphine is given in larger doses, it makes breathing stop. Ativan, I have so many experiences that are not good with Ativan. People get mixed up and confused, and it's just so much better not to use those things. And fact is, I have it put on my record, on my chart, that I'm allergic to Ativan, and that's the only way to keep them from giving it to me.
That's a good idea.
And so that's one of the things that you can learn. If you don't want something, say you're allergic to it, and then that'll stop. And the medical records and pharmacists, they're all alert to those things, that if you're allergic, you won't get them. So that's one of the ways to avoid them if you don't want them.
So you could say you're allergic to morphine, Ativan, fentanyl,
yeah.
Seroquel. I mean, you could list those down and say, I'm allergic to them. And if the doctor says, what happens, I quit breathing, right?
Yes. Now you have to be very careful, though, as to how far you want to carry those things, because those medications are good things to help people when they have a broken leg, for instance, to get morphine or fentanyl till the painful part goes by. Pain, by the way, is built into the body to stimulate healing. And it's also to tell you that something's wrong. And so to the pain and suffering are different things. And the society is all geared into no pain. Well, pain is built in to tell you that something's wrong. Pain is built in to stimulate healing. And so I don't want people to suffer, but these medications have to be used very cautiously.
Responsibly. Okay, I don't mean to cut you off, but we're kind of at our end. I want to thank you so much for coming on tonight. You've given us a lot of information, and I'm going to repost out there on our site. We have Murdered by Hospice Facebook group, and I'm going to repost some of the information that you gave us tonight. And I just want to tell everybody to continue to try to make a difference, tell your stories. If you want to tell your story on the show, my email is listed, marciajoyner2018@gmail.com. And everybody has the right to write the last chapter of your life. Somebody else shouldn't be writing your last chapter in your story. And we will be back in 2 weeks on May the 15th. Thank you so much, Dr. Byrne, for coming on. You have been
Marcia,
a pleasure to
you.
Listen to.
Marcia, thank you for inviting me. And your audience, thank you for listening. If we can help, ask Marcia if she knows how to get a hold of me.
Dr. Byrne.
Right. Marty?
Yes, Dr. Byrne, I want to have you back on my show. You've just blown me away tonight. You've crossed over into areas that I cover. And, Marcia, this was a stellar interview. But I would like you to consider coming back on my show. You need to be out there more. That's all I know. I've never heard anybody speak so honestly about this stuff, and it's information people need to have. So I hope you'll consider that.
So knowledgeable.
Yes. And, Marcia, thank you.
We'll do it. I can't do it for a couple of weeks because I'm crowded for the next couple of weeks. But then after that, I can do it. But we can
save
plan
a spot
on it, though,
for me.
Marty.
All right.
Yeah,
well,
I definitely
we'll do it, Marty.
Think.
We'll stay in touch.
Yeah,
okay,
I definitely think
Marcia.
You need to be back on. You've got a ton of information for our listeners.
Yeah, you need to do that, too. Follow up. Okay. Bye.
Okay.
Thanks
a
lot.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Bye.
And good night, everybody. Bye-bye.